Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth, not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Greetings unto thee, my brothers and sisters in heathenry. So glad you're here. Today's broadcast is going to be a fun one. It's about ignorance. Now, we're not talking about, like, stupidity. Ignorance can be fixed. Like, you can replace ignorance with knowledge. You can teach an ignorant person about something. This is not the same as just being an idiot. Somebody who just seems to operate in their lives with the IQ of a doorknob. You know, you give them the opportunity to do the right thing, say the right thing, make the wise choice. They will always just drive over a cliff. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about ignorance, not knowing. Maybe you were never taught. Maybe you were misled by bad agents or bad information. I was reading this article about the deep fakes, those alarmingly realistic fake videos that show people saying things they never actually said. I mean, wow, it's alarmingly good, well-produced, and I mean that in a terrifying way. I mean, we're already at the point when it's so hard to tell the difference sometimes. Just another piece of the misinformation puzzle, right? Well, I don't know about you, but I get overwhelmed sometimes. You see a clip, you read an article, you look at a photo, you got to verify, is this real? Well, how do we do that? The Great Courses Plus has a fantastic resource. It's a series designed to help us separate fact from fiction. The course I'm talking about is called Fighting Misinformation, Digital Media Literacy. Now, this is more than just a tap on the shoulder that says, hey, go fact check. You know, go to Snopes. The series gets into how our brains process information, cognitive bias, how that works, how we might be predisposed to accept something that's factually wrong. How do we deal with bogus websites and fake reviews and the bots and the scammers and the trolls? Fighting Misinformation is one of just thousands of lectures at the Great Courses Plus on a huge variety of issues. It streams to your computer, your laptop, your tablet, or via the Great Courses Plus app. Feed your curiosity and get some good information with the Great Courses Plus. Right now, my listeners can get a free trial with unlimited access, but you got to sign up today at my special URL to get started. TheGreatCoursesPlus.com/Seth. Don't wait. TheGreatCoursesPlus.com/Seth. I thought I would be further along in my life right now. I remember the confidence of youth. I mean, you know everything when you're young. And if you don't know it, then it's not anything you really needed to know, and so screw it. I'm a middle-aged man. I look around at the world and I'm like, I should know more about stuff. I should have a better grasp on the world I live in. And yet, the more I learn, the more I realize how ignorant I am. And it scares me. Case in point. The national debt. I mean, they just throw scary numbers at you all the time. Oh, the national debt's out of control. The national debt is $24 trillion. You can't even process that. Like 24 trillion? Trillion? Okay, wait a minute. So a billion is 1,000 million, and a trillion is 1,000 billion times 24. That's $24 trillion. National debt. 24 trillion. The number is so overwhelming, it's like trying to comprehend the universe. The human mind is not able to really process it. And then you start asking other questions. Okay, hang on. The national debt, we're in debt to who are we in debt to? The United States owes money to who? Okay, well, that's got to be other nations. This is a trade deficit of some kind. I mean, we've been trading and how did we get into debt in the first place? Who do we owe the money to, specifically? I don't know. I mean, think about it. Do you know who we owe money to? You know? Who do we owe $24 trillion to? And what happens if we don't pay? Like, okay, fine. We are the United States of America. Some would argue that we are the most powerful and influential nation on the planet. I'm not sure that's the case. And as we've discussed in many instances on this show, we fail in a lot of the metrics for greatness across the planet. You know, we aren't all that, all right, here in the United States, but we are a major superpower, all right? So the United States has a $24 trillion debt. What happens when we look at our debt collectors and say, screw you, I'm not paying? Does somebody own us? Like, does someone foreclose on the United States and then we just get annexed into another country? What happens if we can't pay the debt? Because we'll never pay it. $24 trillion? Are you shitting me? This is like a magnification of you have a $20,000 credit card debt at 30% interest, and you are paying the minimum payment of $20 a month. The interest is just exploding exponentially. You'll never get out. You'll never get out from under this debt. It's always, you're going to suffocate. The creditors are going to come. They're going to take your house, your cars, your furniture. They're going to ruin your credit rating. You will be ruined. Does this happen to the United States? Because at some point, if we owe $24 trillion, somebody would be like, hey, you know what? The bills due, man. You know, debt forgiveness, that's out. It is time for you to put up or shut up or what? What happens if we don't pay the debt? I'm a 52-year-old man. I should know this. I should know the answer to this question. Because everyone tells me how it's going to ruin our future when we're passing this debt off into our children and their children and their children. And it's just, what does that mean? I mean, how much will that be in another 10 years? What would our kids even remotely begin to do about it? I don't know. I have questions I do not know the answer to. You ever do that? You ever just look around and think, I should know this. This seems important. Why do I not have this in my knowledge base? So then, as a rationalist, you decide to get educated and you go ask the question, well, what is the national debt? Well, it's an integral part of our processes economically. It relates to our gross domestic product. Okay, all right. Well, I vaguely get gross domestic product, but is the product an actual product? It's a gross domestic product, but what the GDP? Okay, all right, now let's get our head around that. The GDP, the total market value of all the goods and services produced within our border in a specific time period. All right. I got my head around that. We get GDP, all right? Essentially, it's the value of all the shit we do and sell, the GDP. The deficit means that we're, as a government, as a nation, spending more money than we are earning in terms of taxes, et cetera. So we try to compensate by issuing bills and notes and bonds, which are like taking out a loan. And we borrow from investors both within and outside of the United States, whether it's corporations, financial institutions, governments all around the world. Okay, now it's starting to make sense. Hang on. So we are spending a shit ton more money than we are earning in terms of governmental revenue. We can't sustain it, so we go out and we borrow from anybody and everybody and their dog. We borrow, we borrow, we borrow, and this debt accrues, okay? So now we owe creditors $24 trillion. What the? What? Okay, wait, where does that end? How do we get there to begin with? At some point, when you know you hit the first trillion, do you stop and look around and go, you know what, we need to get a different thing going here? If you were balancing the checkbook in your own living room, right, you're doing like a financial budget for the year. And you're like, oh, honey, come here. Look at this. It looks like we're going to be $1 trillion over for the year. At some point, would you not look at each other and go, you know what? We need to trim. We need to cut back. No more eating out, honey. No more restaurants. You know what? You can't have that $500 battery-powered cobalt electric lawnmower this year. We got to use the old pull-start gas mower till it wears out because you got to make things last. We're going to be $1 trillion in the hole. Can't do that. Maybe we need to downsize, sell the house, live in an apartment for a few years till we can get things balanced out. Don't you think, dear? I mean, otherwise, it's $1 trillion in the hole. At some point, did the government not look around and go, holy shit, this year it looks like we're going to be down another $1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 happens if the government says, I ain't paying, which is something that a lot of people are saying that we should just do. You know what? $24 trillion might as well be $240 trillion. Nobody gives a shit. Nobody expects it to be paid back. Let's just leave it. Let's just leave it and let's go down to Daytona and have a kegger and just party like it's 1999. And whatever happens is going to happen. We know the foreclosers aren't really going to come. Like, you know, they're not going to come and put a trailer hitch on the United States and repossess the whole country. We know that's not going to happen. So screw them. These are basics about my own country that I should know more about. I should be able to get my head around, and I just don't. Here's another great example of something I should know. Worse than the fact that I should know it, we did a broadcast, it's been a couple of years, and I had somebody, an expert on the show, to explain it. I still don't understand the difference between DC and AC electrical current. Like, what's the difference between plugging something in and getting electricity out of your cigarette lighter in your car and plugging in the 2 or 3 prong AC outlet into the wall of your house? I tried to get my head around this. I thought, let's go to the experts. I invited an actual electrician who explained it to me on the radio, and I still have no idea how it works. Well, DC's direct current. AC, well, that's amplitude, amplified current. No, wait, it's alternating. I think that's alternating current. What alternates on this current? It alternates, like it back and forth alternates. Well, wait, it's electrical. It's electricity. What's the difference between DC and AC? I don't know. I have no idea. What's the difference between volts and amps? Like, I'll be standing around, there'll be a group of guys, you know, and they're all this man talk. Well, you know, working on my car, had the pistons out to the Dodge pickup truck, getting ready to try to get in there and tune her up. So the alternator and the And the catalytic converter did this and rotated the tires and got her going, went out and put my gun rack in, doing man stuff. This is how we talk in Oklahoma. This is dude talk in Oklahoma. And you know what? I was in there working in my house, had to put a new light fixture in, and all of a sudden I realized that I hadn't shut off the power at the circuit box, and I got shocked. I could have been killed. But you know what? It ain't the voltage that kills you. It's the amps. What? What? All right, what's the difference between the voltage and the amps? Oh, well, the voltage is like the current that's going through a conduit or a tube. Think of the voltage. It's like water going through a pipe, I think. The amps, that's the force that pushes, like the pressure behind the water in the pipe. So it causes you to get more or a stronger kick of voltage. Am I even close on that score? Like, it ain't the voltage, it's the amps. I still don't know that I understand what this means. You know, I should know this by now. I should understand, especially given the fact that I had a teacher who explained it to me in rudimentary terms, like in monosyllables, in the most basic language, and I just sit there. I still don't know why they call it Bluetooth. You got Bluetooth on your phone? You got Bluetooth on your, on your car stereo? Does it pick up Bluetooth? Is that a Bluetooth headset? We talk about it all the time. We just assume the word into our public discourse. I don't have any clue. Why in the world is it called Bluetooth? There's nothing blue about it. There's nothing toothy about it. Bluetooth? Oh, you know what? Well, let's solve this one. Hang on just a second. Google, why do they call it Bluetooth? Well, we're going to learn something today, kids. Oh, there's a Bluetooth.com. There's a website for Bluetooth. The story behind how Bluetooth got its name. The article says, for how innovative the technology, the name doesn't sound techy. It's not an acronym. It doesn't stand for anything. What does it mean? Surprisingly, the name dates back more than a millennia to King Harold Bluetooth Gormson, who was well known for two things. He united Denmark and Norway in the year 958, and his dead tooth, which was a dark blue-gray color, earned him the nickname Bluetooth. Okay, so we got a king, King Harald Gormson, the uniter of Denmark and Norway over 1,000 years ago, and he had a dead tooth, which was blue. And they called him Bluetooth. All right, we're tracking. Everybody with me here? Okay, let us continue on. Well, in 1996, the leaders of Intel, Ericsson, and Nokia got together. And they were talking about this new short-range radio technology. This is going to allow different products and even industries to connect, right, using wireless short-range radio. And the meeting's going on. The guy from Intel, Jim Kardich, suggested Bluetooth as a temporary code name for the technology. As King Harald Bluetooth was famous for uniting Scandinavia, they wanted to unite PC and cellular industries with this new shortwave wireless technology. It was a unifying thing, and he just pulled it out of his ass and said, Bluetooth, we'll just call it that for now. It was supposed to be a placeholder until the marketing departments could come up with a name that was really techie and cool. They were going to call it Radio Wire. Somebody had called it PAN for personal area networking. In fact, PAN was the front runner. Imagine having a PAN headset or PAN earpiece or PAN radio or something. So then they went back to Radio Wire, but they couldn't get a trademark search done in time for the launch of the product. Well, what have we been calling this technology for the past several years? We've been calling it Bluetooth. I guess we're going to stick with that. We'll just call it Bluetooth. In fact, the initial Bluetooth logo is, it's a rune, and it somehow binds together the initials of this King Harold guy. So when you see that is a rune with a little star thingy in it, or somehow this represents the initials for King Harold Bluetooth Gormson. That's a great story to tell at parties, right? You can look like the smartest person in the room. Hey, you know where they get Bluetooth from, don't you? Yeah, it's King Harold Gormson. I mean, come on. Everybody knows that. United Denmark and Norway back in 1958. He had a Bluetooth. Yeah. Oh, you didn't know that? Well, you're welcome. You're welcome, everybody. Here's another example. I just, in the last few months, have been learning how yeast works. We're like a lot of different people who have had more time at home recently. A few years ago, I began to fall in love with cooking. You know, a guy who used to be the king of the microwave, I really fell in love with spending time in the kitchen, and I enjoy cooking for other people and trying new things. It's been amazing. It's really been therapeutic. It just makes you feel good to be in there creating in the kitchen. But bread's intimidating. Like, bread is just straight up alchemy, right? I mean, so much stuff can go wrong, and it takes so much skill and time, and I just always put it off. I think I tried a loaf of bread last year, and it was like mortar. I mean, you could have broken windows with it. And I got hooked on the Great British Baking Show. You ever watch that broadcast? I think you can stream it on Netflix. That show will flat out suck your life. I'm obsessed with the Great British Baking Show. So we were talking to some friends about making sourdough bread. We're going to attempt it. Turns out our friend Karen has sourdough starter. So she brought us a jar. Now I'm sitting here looking at this jar like, what did you just gift to us? Wait, what starter? Is it like yeast? Well, no, it's not. It's not. Well, it's kind of like yeast. But it's not yeast, it's starter. Okay, wait a minute, it's starter? So it's dough? No, it's not dough, you need it for the dough. Okay, all right. So it's yeast, but not really yeast, and you have to have it before you can make the bread. And then she looks us dead in the eye and she says, and don't forget to feed it. I'm sorry, what? Yeah, you have to feed your starter. It's goop. It's just goop in a jar. What do I feed it? Well, you take some of it out and you put in flour and water and then it ferments and bubbles on itself. You have to feed your starter. So now I'm in a whole new universe. Okay. A man who had already been confused about yeast. I'm sorry. Things that are floating around in the air that you can catch using water and cloth and bowls and shit. I mean, yeast is just always flying around in the air. Well, in my mind, you know what I pictured when someone told me that yeast always is out there flying in the air? I think sea monkeys. We start in our house. We call them air monkeys. I just picture little creatures floating around in the air that you catch and you use to make bread. So is sourdough starter, is that just a goop that contains captured air monkeys? I don't know. All I know is I go in, I take a little bit out, I put in some flour and some water, and I give it half a day, and it almost doubles in size. It's fascinating. And then you use that to start your sourdough bread. We made bread in this house. We made a loaf of sourdough bread that would change your life. First of all, it takes about 2 days to make it happen. You know, you fold it over and then you wait 30 minutes and you fold it again and you wait 30 minutes and you fold it again and you add some flour and you put it in the fridge and you wait all night and you do this and you do that. And you're wondering if it's worth the trouble. And then when it goes into the oven, the house fills with the aroma of freshly baking bread. And I'm guessing the corpses of thousands of air monkeys. You take into your body through the olfactory organs the wonderful heavenly smell of baking sourdough bread. anticipating the moment when the oven door opens and you bring the bread out and let it cool for about an hour, and you take your bread knife and you slice it into. There's a hard crust and inside a wonderfully warm and soft and sort of air-pockety substance, which is homemade bread, and you lather it with butter and you eat it slowly because you want to savor every single bite. It is heaven. If heaven exists, it's homemade sourdough bread. I'm obsessed. I can't stop baking the stuff. Different recipes? Let's try a different recipe. Let's try a different kind of bread. Let's do this. Let's do that. But if you ask me at the beginning of the conversation, hey, what's yeast? I will look at you as if you would ask me to give you an example of one good Uwe Boll film. I can't do it. I cannot do it. Yeast. Just air monkeys, they're floating around and you capture them and somehow they cause you to have fermentation for bread. That's the best I got. That's all I got. That's all I got. Now, here's one more layer to the weirdness. I was told that, you know, your starter, the goop that you start the sourdough starter, you're supposed to name it. This is a tradition that spans hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of years. People name their starter. We named ours Herbert. We heard somewhere that Herbert was a popular name for sourdough starter. And so this leads to some bizarre, like Twilight Zone conversations. Honey, did you feed Herbert today? Or, you know what? I forgot to feed Herbert. Well, I fed Herbert, but he's only about half the size. Herbert isn't bubbling. Don't forget to pour part of Herbert out into the trash unless you plan to make sourdough waffles with the leftover Herbert. You know what? Herbert isn't bubbling correctly. Is Herbert ready to make bread? This is how we talk in the Andrews kitchen. It's a strange universe, using a kind of chemistry that causes me all kinds of intellectual headaches because I don't understand, but I'm making bread. I still don't know why we call it the Civil War. Like the Civil War, we learned about it in history class. We talk about it quite a bit. My favorite documentary is Ken Burns's The Civil War. But wait a minute. Doesn't civil mean civilized? Like polite? You're mannerly? Civil War? 600,000 Americans died horribly during a civil war? Well, I made kind of a mental bookmark on this one. And had the Merriam-Webster page pulled up here on my browser. They, obviously known for defining words, they actually have a definition page for civil war. Like, why do we call it that? Civil began being used in the 14th century. Apparently, it's a variation on the old Latin word civilis, which translates citizen. So, a civil war is a war of citizens or between citizens, opposing groups of citizens in the same country. All right, well, that makes sense. A civilis war. Or is it civilis? No, I like civilis. Civilis sounds like a disease. Like you have a terrible case of civilis. You need to take some penicillin. We'll go with civilis. All right. The Latin word meaning citizen. A war between citizens. We learned something new about the Civil War on this broadcast. Natalie and I were sitting up the other night. We're propped up in the bed, browsing our phones, just killing time, you know. And I was kind of propped up in a funny way. You know, I was kind of awkward there. I hadn't adjusted the pillow. And Natalie looks over and says, "You're going to get a crick in your neck." And all of a sudden, for the first time in my life, I thought, what the hell is a crick? Like a crick in your neck. Merriam-Webster says, the definition of a crick. A painful, spasmodic condition of muscles, as in the neck or back. Okay, a crick. A crick? Apparently, according to Wiktionary, This apparently goes back to the 1400s. The crick, likely related to an Old Norse word, crikey. Crikey or cricky? K-R-I-K-I. This Old Norse word means nook, like a bend in a creek or a crick, right? You see the bend in the creek or the river. It's a bend. I don't know. It just seems a little sketchy to me. So when you've got a crick in your neck, you are essentially invoking Old Norse language that refers to a bend in a creek. Does that wash with you? Like a creek in your neck? You have a creek in your neck? Like we just say it all the time. We don't even know what it means. It's a crick. I don't know what the prostate does. We have prostate exams. I'm a 50-year-old man. Time for your prostate exam to make sure you don't have prostate cancer. Only men have a prostate. What does the prostate do? Hell if I know. I have no idea. Fortunately for you and me, and we're going to talk a lot about bodily function because, you know, we can. There's a Prostate Cancer Foundation website, and it's got some explanations. I'm going to browse through this and summarize. The prostate is a small, squishy gland. It's about the size of a ping pong ball. It's located deep inside the groin. It's between the base of the penis and the rectum. Just kind of hangs out there, apparently, in that middle space, okay? The prostate is important for reproduction. It provides the seminal fluid. This fluid mixes with sperm, and the sperm comes out of the testes or testicles, okay? So think of a water slide. This is how I learn things, right? This is a water slide, all right? So you have the little person on the raft or on the little mat or whatever on the slide. That's the sperm. The seminal fluid is like the water on the water slide that helps the little sperm get wherever they're supposed to go. And that fluid, the water on the water slide, that's made by the prostate. Am I getting that right? This fluid, it's got enzymes in it. It's got something called PSA. It's got zinc and citrate and fructose. Wait, fructose? Like sperm sugar? Apparently, these substances give the sperm energy to make the journey to the egg. So they are nourishing the sperm as they travel out of the testicles toward the egg for fertilization. There's also antibodies that might help protect against things like urinary tract infections. It might protect your sperm from bacteria and other pathogens. So now it's like we're sliding down the water slide and they put like peroxide and alcohol and shit in the water to protect you from germs as you're sliding from the top to the bottom. Okay, we still tracking the prostate. Now, as men get older, the prostate sometimes gets bigger. Apparently, it enlarges. This ping pong ball turns into, I don't know, baseball. I mean, it just gets bigger, all right? This is often why older guys have to stop whatever they're doing and go pee every 15 minutes. These prostate cells, they just multiply. This is not a cancerous thing, usually. They just multiply. There's more of them, and this enlarges the prostate, and that puts pressure on the urethra. That's the slide. All right, the urethra is the water slide that all this stuff sort of goes down. Okay, so the water slide through which all the urine has to go, this gets squeezed by your prostate when it gets big. And this narrows the water slide. There's tons of pressure on it, so it narrows that corridor, and the bladder's got to work harder to try to empty itself. This means the bladder muscle might be flexing. Right? It's trying to push the urine through, and all this muscle use actually makes the bladder stronger and thicker. It builds up those muscle walls. It's more substantial and sensitive. And then it comes to a point when sometimes it starts to contract even when your bladder's not full, right? So you feel this urge to pee even if your bladder might not actually have to pee. Everybody tracking. All right, so let's recap. The prostate makes fluid that carries sperm and might help keep the urinary tract free from infection. The prostate gets bigger as men get older. This makes the urinary tract feel like it's being suffocated. It's being suffocated by this angry, squishy ping pong ball. And then the bladder overreacts by getting all big and muscly and overreactive. The prostate. So the next time you go in for the annual checkup, you know, the middle-aged man annual checkup, and the dog goes over to the little box and he grabs the lube and the rubber glove. Just think about the squishy ping pong ball that he is accessing through your rectum. And you're welcome. Here's one more related to male reproduction. This is courtesy of John on Facebook. He had this question. He said, how does morning wood happen? You're familiar with that term, right? Morning wood. Morning wood? Well, if you are unaware for any reason, frequently when men wake up in the morning, they have, I don't even know how to say this, like men, when they first wake up in the morning, sometimes have a woody, okay, a stimulus package, you know, a swellington is what they have, a standing ovation, the hard floppy, the flag is at full mast, it's a breakfast burrito, okay, they have an erection. Now, hang on just a second. Why do men get erections in the morning? I don't know. Let's figure this one out. Hang on just a second. Why do men get erection? Why do men get erectile dysfunction? No, that's autofill. Erections in the morning. Oh, it comes right up. yeah, sorry, that's a play on words. It comes right up. It's Healthline has an article. Oh, there's a medical term for this phenomenon. NPT, nocturnal penile tumescence. I'd rather call it that, you know, than the breakfast burrito. I'm just saying. It's common in younger men. It is experienced by men of all ages. Many people assume a morning erection is a sign of sexual stimulation. This is not always the case. It's likely a response your body has to one of several natural occurrences. Morning wood can be prompted by physical touch. Even when you're sleeping, your body still reacts to stimuli. So let's say you're lying there, totally asleep, totally unconscious, your partner grazes against you as you sleep, and then the body does what it does, right? It's a reflex. Hormone shifts may cause this. Testosterone is highest in the morning, right after you wake up from REM sleep. So your testosterone is highest first thing in the morning, right after you get up. Brain relaxation. When you're awake, the male body releases hormones to suppress erections. All right, so when you're out and about and doing what you do throughout the day, you're going to work or mowing the lawn or, I mean, whatever. The body is actively working to keep men from getting a boner while they're awake. You know, I guess that makes sense, right? I mean, it's, you know, you don't want to walk around. You don't want to be at a party, you know what I'm saying? You don't want to be at a board meeting or something like that. And, you know, you're in a non-sexual situation and it's like, oh, shit, I get that. And when men sleep, the body relaxes and it releases less of those inhibiting hormones. The body doesn't feel the need to protect you from embarrassment as you sleep, so it's possibly more likely that you will react physically. Healthline says Morning erections can be a sign of a properly functioning blood and nervous system around the penis. Now, this is good news for men, right? I mean, if it happens to you, like you wake up in the morning and it happens, you can perhaps, you know, breathe a sigh of unembarrassed relief, you know, and you can just tell yourself, congratulations to me, I have a working penis. Thank you, John. Thanks for taking us on that little ride. Appreciate that. I mean, it's interesting. One of those things you wonder about, but why does it happen? Now, while we're in this particular region, why do we call it the fly? Hey, your fly's open. Zip your fly. Wait a minute. No, it's a zipper. But we call it a fly? We always call it a fly. Why is your fly open? It's like saying your swim is open. Your lunge is open. Your climb is open. Just makes no sense when you stop to think about it. I looked this one up. Apparently, it comes from an old English word, flowin', F-L-O-W-A-N, flowin', to flow. It also came to mean something that's attached by one edge. So you got a flap and it's just sewn at the top, but not the bottom. That was adopted by 19th century tailors. The fly was any flap of cloth attached at one end to cover an opening in a garment, your fly. Now that sensation that you're feeling in your skull right now, that pressure, that's just your brain expanding. Like all the new knowledge is causing your brain to press against the skull. That's what you're feeling right now. We know what we did not know. And there's still so much that I do not know. I don't even know how aspirin works. Like my head is killing me, honey. I need to go and take an aspirin. I guess most people take like the Tylenol and Motrin, Excedrin, ibuprofen, whatever. But I mean, we've all got aspirin in the medicine cabinet. Sometimes I'll take an aspirin for a headache. What's up with that? Like, you take it. It's like a magic pill. I have a headache. I take an aspirin, and the headache usually goes away. What's that about? I don't understand. I just do it. I'm a creature of reflex. I'm a creature of habit. Honey, go take an aspirin. That'll get rid of the headache. I've heard it has something to do with relaxing the blood vessels or something, like the blood vessels restrict. But have I really ever stopped to understand? Why do these magic white pills work on headaches? Well, Ecotrin is a brand of aspirin, and they've got this educational page. So fine. I mean, they make aspirin. I'm guessing they're qualified to explain aspirin. Now, it's a long page, so I'm just going to summarize, and we're going to learn together right now how aspirin works. Are you ready? We got to start with pain. Like, what's pain? We feel pain, but why? Well, pain sensation results when the nerves in our bodies send these electrical signals to the brain. Let's say you've got an injury, right? You're in the kitchen and you've got your bread knife out and you are slicing your newly baked sourdough bread, anticipating that first bite. And as you slice the bread, shit, I cut my finger. Okay, nasty cut on the finger. By the way, everyone says shit when they cut themselves with a bread knife. You know, it's just a shit. All right, so you cut your finger. The damaged tissues release these little chemicals. They're called prostaglandins. And these prostaglandins cause the tissues to swell. And also, because these prostaglandins are apparently little assholes, they intensify the pain signals that come out of your nerves. They actually make the pain a lot worse. Thank you very much. Now, prostaglandins do a lot of important and beneficial stuff relating to blood pressure and getting good airflow to the lungs and gastrointestinal stuff, etc. But right now I'm talking about the pain. And that's why I call the prostaglandins the little assholes there. Because, you know, this doesn't have to be. They could just send you a message that your brain would receive. Hello, you have an injury that may be a problem. Like if I was an intelligent designer, I'm God looking down, I would have created a system where you know without question you are seriously injured in some way, but it doesn't send you into a debilitating screaming fit where you are possibly incapacitated because of the electrical overload to your brain. That's just my take on pain, okay? Aspirin chemically blocks the effects of certain enzymes that create them. All right, so you have less of the little asshole prostaglandins, and if you have less of those, it means you have less swelling, and the prostaglandins are not blasting your existing pain signals through a guitar amplifier. Okay, are we tracking? We got pain, we got swelling. Aspirin blocks chemicals that amplify the pain and the swelling. Now, headaches come from a lot of different places. They can be caused by everything from eye strain, sinus inflammation, like the sinus headache. Congestion can cause it. Tension headaches, migraine headaches, hormone headaches. Headaches can come from illness or stress, the environment, even the genome. You can have genetic reasons you've got headaches. So this is a really complex thing. Let's talk about the standard headache. Standard headache pain comes from a mix of signals between the brain and the blood vessels and the nerves that are around them. And this is not totally understood even today, right? For reasons we don't fully understand, nerves in the blood vessels and in the muscles of our heads turn on. When they switch on, we see the production, again, of the little assholes, the prostaglandins, produced in swelling, and they do what they do. They amplify the pain, and they make you feel like a monster truck just parked on your head. So aspirin comes in to save the day. It blocks the production of those prostaglandins so that the pain is not amplified. It reduces the pain. Now, this is, of course, an explanation that is probably giving the doctors in my audience a headache. Are you screaming at me? Are you desperate to dial in and tell me how wrong I am? I mean, I got this from the aspirin website. By the way, why do we continue to hear that if you take an aspirin a day, you might help prevent heart attacks and strokes? How does that happen? Well, aspirin works as a blood thinner. Essentially, it prevents the platelets in the blood from clumping together. Clumping is bad, right? We do not want clumpy blood. Clumping can mean clotting in the arteries. That means blockages to blood flow. Harvard University has published some material on how all this works. In the early stages of heart disease, cholesterol builds up in the walls of our coronary arteries. Now, hang on just a second. What's cholesterol? I mean, that's bad, right? Or wait, there's good cholesterol. It's bad cholesterol. Somebody like me, I just accept it. What's cholesterol? I don't know. Let's clear this one up before we move on. Cholesterol is this waxy, fat-like substance. You can find it in all the cells of our bodies, right? And you got to have some cholesterol. It makes hormones. It makes vitamin D. It's got stuff in it that helps us to digest our food. All right, so cholesterol. It's part of the healthy body's machine. I guess that's what they mean when they say, how's your good cholesterol, right? And the body makes all that it needs. But cholesterol is also in foods that we ingest. And that means we get too much of this waxy, fatty stuff in our cells. And that stuff can build up in the arteries. So these deposits build up and they trigger inflammation, and those inflammations make plaque or result in plaque that builds up in the artery. That means there's less blood flow getting through because now you got plaque that's sort of blocking part of the door. The heart's not getting all the blood it needs. You might get angina or chest pain. And so if this plaque is built up, sometimes the plaque ruptures and it leaks those contents of whatever's in it into the bloodstream. And then tiny blood cells called platelets, they stick to the ruptured plaque. And then those platelets get all sticky and they build up and they clot and the artery gets totally blocked. Then the heart muscle's not getting blood. Now you're in full-on heart attack. Okay, so there's a lot of links in this chain, but you get the picture. Cholesterol, waxy, fatty stuff, overloads the cells, starts the process of clogging the arteries, blocking blood flow to the heart. Heart muscle starts to die because it's starving to death. Now you're screwed. Okay? Aspirin prevents heart attacks because it prevents those platelets from sticking together and forming the clots around the plaque and stuff. So that's breaking the link in the chain of all the stuff that's going on. Aspirin jumps in and says, hang on, we're going to interrupt the process. We're going to stop these platelets, these sticky platelets, from all coming together and leading to blockages in the artery. So those people who are taking an aspirin a day, they're essentially trying to get in front of this process so that the buildup and the clotting and the clogging doesn't take place. Now, I have to say this. Preventative aspirin is not for everyone. Our discussion today does not constitute medical advice. Please consult your physician. You know what I'm saying? You don't come to this show to get diagnoses. All right, we're just talking. We're just learning, you know, as best we can. Using layman's terms, we're trying to understand complicated stuff using the most rudimentary of language. How you doing with this stuff? I mean, is this as interesting to you as it is to me? Because Uncle Seth is cracking open a knowledge egg on this audience today. I'm just saying. And I've got more. I got more of this stuff queued up. Let us take a short break. I will be right back. As our brains continue to expand on the other side of this. How much could you save in 1 year by switching to Harry's? Well, you could save enough to buy 26 cups of coffee in New York City. You could get 3 deep dish pizza dinners in Chicago. You could get 6 months on your Netflix subscription. How could you do this? Harry's delivers high-quality razor blades as low as $2 each. That's a fraction of the price of the leading brand and saves you hundreds of dollars over time. I like the closeness of Harry's shave. I just like what they do. The ergonomic handle feels like quality in my hands. The presentation is so nice. I often give Harry's as gifts on special occasions. You can get a Harry's trial set delivered right to your doorstep. Just go to harrys.com/thethinkingatheist. Harry ships right to your door. All your grooming needs covered in one stop. Your blades, hair care, shower products, they're all at harrys.com. And you can feel better about the purchase because 1% of proceeds are set aside for nonprofit organizations. And right now in these times, Harry's is donating $1 million in shaving supplies to hospitals across the United States. Right now, listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/thethinkingatheist. You will get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/thethinkingatheist to start shaving and saving today.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
My patrons get this show early. They get it totally commercial free. And I so appreciate your support. If you are not a patron, please consider becoming one. Patreon.com/Seth Andrews. And you have my thanks for that. This is just a show about knowledge, not important stuff, not life-changing, world-changing knowledge, just the stuff that we do, we say, we take for granted all the time. I've just had stuff on my mind, and I thought it might interest you. I mean, if we're thinkers, if we are thinking atheists, let's think about some of the things that we do and say every day. On my Facebook page, we were having a discussion about all the stuff we don't know. Diana had one. It's a little disgusting, but no less fascinating, really. When you flush the toilet, where does your poop go? Well, it goes to the sewer, or the sewer system. Unless you have a septic tank, then we know it goes out to the tank and it breaks down and goes into the earth. But I mean, what about city dwellers, right? Well, the sewer? It drains out? What, does it go to a river or something? I don't know the answer to this. Oh, it goes to a treatment plant. All right, fine. What does that mean? What happens after that? Now, I looked this one up in advance. I didn't even know how to Google it, right? Fortunately, I just started typing in the phrase, when you flush the toilet. It came right up. It popped right out, if you will pardon the expression, okay? Live Science has an article called Where Does All Our Poop Go? And we produce a lot of it. The average adult flushes about 320 pounds of poop down the toilet every single year. Turns out that our shit is surprisingly useful. Here's how the process goes, according to Live Science. And again, I'm paraphrasing. From the toilet, our excrement flows out through the city's sewage system. And that thing's like a catch-all. At the water out of your sink, and it drains out of your shower, and rainwater from the streets, and all that stuff goes into the sewage system. And that stuff gets routed to a wastewater treatment plant. So all this stuff kind of settles into this nasty sludge. Now, I hope you're not eating as we talk about it. This is important. This is education. All right. So all that stuff comes together, becomes a sludge, and they have a series of tanks that they move this sludge through. Did you know that there are tons, millions upon millions of microorganisms that live in our poop? So when the stuff is sitting in this big sludge tank, these microorganisms breathe in oxygen. I mean, they don't breathe. They take in oxygen, and they also eat the bad stuff. They eat nitrogen and phosphorus and a lot of toxic type stuff. Bad things, I guess. So essentially, this is like a big chemical reaction going on in the sludge. And so in another tank, these microorganisms break things down even further. They convert our poop into mostly water, methane, and carbon dioxide. This horrifying lake of post-poop, the lake of liquid that remains, they take it and they dry it out in a centrifuge, and they use what's left. It's called a biosolid, this dried out biosolid. They use that stuff in a bunch of ways. They fertilize crops. Relax. Very little of it is used to fertilize food that we eat. It's like 1-2% of the crops that feed people are fed by people poop. All right, so just relax. Over half of all processed poop is used for agriculture of some kind. 17% of the biosolids, they burn that stuff. They burn it to produce energy. It becomes a form of natural gas. In fact, some of these wastewater plants are actually fueled by the poop that they're processing. It's like a circular thing, right? They process the poop, it creates the gas, they use the gas to run the machines that process the poop. It's an industry that runs on itself. And whatever's left ends up in landfills. Now, there's a big push to stop taking the leftovers to the landfills, because there are some people who are like, hey, wait a minute, we can still use this stuff to make more fuel, to power the rest of our lives, the stuff that uses energy. Imagine you're at your house and you flush the toilet and the poop goes into some kind of, I don't know. It goes into a personal poop processor somewhere in your house, and it gets broken down, and the microorganisms do what they do, and the gases are created. It converts to fuel, and that fuel then turns on your lights and runs your appliances and powers your house. I mean, you could tell people with pride, I live in a shithole. A house that powers itself with poop. And it would be a good thing. Like, this would not be something to be embarrassed about. Would you like to come back to the shithole and hang out? I mean, I learned something new. Now, when somebody flushes the toilet, now you know what happens to it. Doesn't magically disappear. Doesn't magically just go off and vaporize into the air. It actually gets used for a, if you'll pardon the expression, shit ton of stuff. What's another one? I've mentioned this before. I still don't fully understand the royal family. I'm interested, I guess, in them. Like you would be interested in something in a cursory way. But I mean, the royal family? What's the purpose of the royal family in the year 2020? I mean, is it just tourism? When we went to London, and I'm admitting it outright, we went to London, Natalie and I went and visited Buckingham Palace and saw the changing of the guard, and we were excited to go. By the way, the changing of the guard is 45 minutes of the biggest nothing you have ever seen. We just stand outside the gate. We the sheeple, were standing outside the gate. And all of a sudden, you see somebody, and they come around a corner, then they bring in somebody else, and then they do this, and they gesticulate in some way, and then there's a marching band, and they march in from some other place, and then they all move around, and at the end of the day, they just changed out a few people, but they had this pomp and ceremony all around. It was 45 minutes of the biggest nothing I have ever seen. But we were there. We were attracted to it. We were fascinated by it. Why? Like, somebody explain this idea that you're born better than someone else. This divine right of kings. You are shot out of the womb of a specific person. Therefore, you are what? You're destined to be superior and to be given a life of wealth and power and privilege. I don't understand that. I'm not saying I reject wholesale the idea of the monarchy, okay? Don't get offended by my questions. But, is tradition enough? Does it give people comfort, this symbolism, you know, for queen and country, God save the queen? Do they have any ruling power? Does the queen involve herself in any meaningful way in government, you know, the managing of the structure of society and its constitution? Or is that simply the prime minister and parliament, and she's totally symbolic and she doesn't really affect the process at all? I don't know. From over here in America, I'm interested in it. I'm fascinated by it. We're fascinated by the royal family. Oh, look, so-and-so had a baby. Oh, there's Angel Song, and the music plays, and the tabloids go crazy, and there are photographs plastered across the planet. And I'm over here thinking, how many babies are born every single day? What specifically is special about this baby, this birth? I don't get it. Well, it's tradition. Okay, well, is that really a good argument? Tradition does have its utility. Sometimes tradition can help to frame the human experience, but sometimes it's just dumb. What's that meme? Shows somebody at the running of the bulls ceremony, and it says, tradition. Just because you've always done it that way doesn't mean it's not incredibly stupid. There's another gem out there. It says, tradition. Peer pressure from dead people. So does the royal family genuinely survive the tradition argument? Is it a worthy tradition? I have questions. And here's some irony. One of my favorite movies is a Stephen Frears directed film starring Helen Mirren. It's called The Queen, and it deals with the Queen's actions or lack of in the wake of the death of Princess Diana. It's a hugely moving film. If you haven't seen The Queen, I think it may be on Netflix. You should check it out. I mean, it's a compelling story, you know. I had somebody on Facebook ask this one, and at first I thought it was kind of a nothing question, and I brushed it off, but I found myself thinking about it later on. Why do we spend a third of our lives unconscious? Like, somebody explain sleep to me. I understand why we need sleep. We all get it, that you've got to go and recharge the body, so you need to sleep. But this would be a great question for religious people. Like, if we're intelligently designed, why don't we have solar panels or something else? You know, why don't we regenerate our energy constantly so that one third of our lives is not spent unconscious? Now, having said that, especially as a man in his 50s, I love my sleep. I mean, when you're a kid, they used to be like, you need to go take a nap. It's time to take a nap. No, I don't want to take a nap. Yes, it is time to go take a nap. I don't want to take a nap. Now, any time of day, you come to me and you say, hey, let's take a nap. I'm there. I am so there. You know, take the blackout curtains and pull them shut at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Grab a soft pillow and cuddle up and let's just sleep. Oh, blissful, gentle, warm, under the covers sleep. Oh, yeah, you don't have to talk me into my sleep. I love it. But if you think about it, a third of our lives we spend not being able to participate in our lives. We are sleeping. Why have we not evolved some sort of regenerative quality that allows us to use more hours in the day? And would we want that knowing how wonderful sleep really is? Oh, you know it feels good. You curl up under the covers and just, yeah. Would you want to live in a world without a bedtime? I don't think I would. I really don't. I still don't fully understand how microwaves cook my food. There's radiation. I think there are water particles or something involved. I've known people who won't eat microwaved food because they're afraid of, like, radiation, like uranium radiation. Well, I know that's not real. This is a different kind of radiating that's taking place, but I don't really get it. I just know I put a baked potato in the microwave and I click the baked potato button and 4 minutes later it comes out and it's done. By the way, can you taste a difference between a baked potato that's made in the microwave and one that cooks for an hour in the oven wrapped in aluminum foil? Because I can't. I went on Facebook and I said, can you tell the difference between a baked potato and a microwaved baked potato? And opinions were all over the place. I can't tell the difference. Like, there's a sentimental quality to having the old school baked potato. You know, you pull it out of the oven, it's taken so much time and care and love, and so maybe it means more to you. But can you really taste the difference if you had a taste test? Side-by-side, blind taste test. Oven, microwave, could you really tell the difference? I don't know. But back to the microwave, okay? How does the microwave cook our food? There's a website called Explain That Stuff, and it's got little diagrams. It's a perfect website for a guy like me. It says, inside this strong metal box, there's a generator, a microwave generator. It's called a magnetron. And the magnetron takes electricity from your power outlet, and it converts that electricity into high-powered radio waves. And it blasts those radio waves through the interior of the microwave, and it bounces off the metal walls. So they're bouncing. These radio waves are bouncing back and forth off the reflective metal walls of the inner compartment of the microwave. It's kind of like light bouncing off of a mirror. And when these microwaves reach the food, they don't just bounce off the food. They can pass right through it. They penetrate the food. And as they travel through your food, it makes the molecules inside the food vibrate quickly. And this vibration produces heat. And the faster these molecules vibrate, the more friction. That means heat. The hotter the food becomes, the more it cooks. These microwaves are passing energy onto the molecules in the food. And that's how it heats up. It actually cooks from the inside out, which is different than the conventional oven, which has these elements that throw heat at it from the outside, cooking it from the outside in. With a microwave, you're going right through the food. You're causing the molecules to get excited. They have friction against each other, generating heat. Your food cooks from within. By the way, the microwave was invented by a guy named Percy Spencer. He was trying to develop technology that used radio waves for airplanes and ships in poor weather and in darkness. So he was doing a whole other thing. And according to the story, he had a chocolate bar in his pocket when he switched on the magnetron. And all of a sudden, the chocolate bar melted because of the heat that the magnetron generated. So he had this light bulb moment. Hey, wait a minute. A magnetron might be used to cook food. He tried it on popcorn, tried it on all kinds of food. Back in the 50s, he got a bunch of patents. He ended up with over 130 different patents on the microwave oven. My grandmother had one of the first microwave ovens back when they first became available to the purchasing public. I was just a kid. I was really small. And the microwave was massive. It was this big. It's like the size of a small television. And it sat on this table. She had to dedicate a whole table to it. Had a big crank dial on the front of it. But man, this was like, you know, we had seen fire for the first time. It was like the coolest thing ever. I'll always remember that microwave oven at Grandma's house. Anyway, that's how we cook food in microwaves. While we're talking about microwaves, why can't you put metal in a microwave? You've got a plate of food. The fork is laying on the plate. You forget. You toss it in there. You got sparks and chaos, and I think it can even damage the microwave oven. What's the problem? Wouldn't these radio waves just bounce off the other metal like it's bouncing off the reflective sides of the box? I don't understand. Let's find out. Why can't you put metal? Pops right up. Why can't you put metal in the microwave? This is from thekitchen.com. The website says part of the problem with metals is that they are a lot more solid than food. As food gets hot, water just converts to steam. The energy gets released. As the molecules inside a piece of aluminum foil heat up, they don't have anywhere to go. The metal heats up very rapidly and will eventually catch on fire. Depending on the shape and the surface smoothness of whatever metal thing you put in the microwave, I don't know, let's call it silverware, okay? You put that in there, some metal objects will reflect the microwaves back instead of absorbing them. So the wave hits your metal object, it bounces off, it hits the walls, it bounces off, it hits the object again, it bounces off, back and forth, so much so that the transmitter starts to overheat and you can damage the machine. Another problem is that metals are electrically conductive. Let's say the object is a fork. It has pointy edges on it. Or you've got any metal object that has a pointy part of it. Electrons will collect at those edges. And when enough of those electrons build up, you can actually create an electrical arc that jumps between the metal and the electromagnetic transmitter. This will make like a mini lightning show inside your microwave. It's awesome and terrifying at the same time. Final note on microwaves. If you've got an old DVD or CD in your collection, something you know you will probably throw away, never use for any reason, put it in the microwave. Now, I don't actually, you want to check this because I don't want to damage your microwave. But if you want to see a light show, take an old CD or DVD, put it in the microwave, hit start, and about 5 seconds later, you will get one hell of a show. You know what? Don't do it yourself. Let's play it safe. Go to YouTube and type in DVD microwave. In fact, let me see if I can find it just to make sure I'm not leading you astray. Microwave a DVD. Oh, yeah, there it is. It pops right up. This particular video is called Microwave DVD Fun. And they've got it in slow motion. So anyway, save the microwave in your own house. Go watch somebody else do it. I thought it was awesome. Thank you so much for taking this journey with me. We may have to do this again. I enjoy these sort of general knowledge shows, or I guess vent shows, you know, just talking, you know, just about whatever happens to come up. And you never know where that road's going to take you, right? I mean, what have we covered today? Everything from the prostate to microwaving DVDs to the royal family to the impending economic collapse of the United States. I mean, you just don't get this kind of variety in every show. I'm just saying. Be safe out there. I will see you back here next week on the Thinking Atheist podcast. Take care.
Follow the Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.